The Sins of the Fathers by Christiana Rand. The night was dark, but the wind that rustled the stunted branches of the scrub oak in the hanging forest was balmy and warm. It was not against the cold that the rider hugged his jacket so close about him, slipping down from the saddle, walking forward, reluctant and slow, towards that ruined place. It had been a small cottage once, cozy and warm, but the years of desertion had let in the wild rain among the stones that formed its simple walls, softening the clay that bound them, tumbling in the blue-grey slates of the roof, opening wider the wide chimney to the heat and mountainous twigs of the jackdaw's nests, almost as long abandoned as the place itself. Yet, where nowadays not even the jackdaws built, there came from the unglassed window a glimmer of light, and at the sound of the pony's hooves, unshod on the grass outside, someone came to the door, and a woman's voice called, though faintly. "Who's there?" He stopped, shivering, clutching across his breast the edges of his coat, as though the close-woven wool of his own mountain sheep might hold some magic to keep his body from harm, and without preamble or greeting called back in their native Welsh, "I come for the sin eater." "Then you may go back," she said. "He cannot come." Not come? There was sickness abroad. Many were dead. The sin eaters were being kept busy. He grew anxious, urgent, coming closer. The pony's single rein looped over his arm. "He must come. I've been searching 3 days. I can get nobody else. The sin-eater from Tregaron himself is sick. The one at Killicum died yesterday." "I did not know," she said, and in her voice there seemed the faint echo of a new despair. He was hardly surprised. "Living so isolated here," she interrupted bitterly. "All sin-eaters live isolated. Our men take your sins upon them, and for that you cast them out." He shrugged. Who would wish to associate with such as they? Men pre-doomed for all eternity, heavy with the load of other men's transgressions. "We pay, and there is a good meal." A good meal. The worse the sinner, the better the banquet. They spread out the food upon the dead man's bosom, and from there you ate the meal, and with it the dead man's sins. And the dead, made innocent again, went directly to glory, and you were paid, and kicked out to live a pariah till they had need of you again. "At any rate," said the woman, turning back into the doorway, "my man is sick. He can't come." He dared not go back without a sin-eater. "I can get no one else. The time is passing. My master must be buried tomorrow. The mistress is distraught, lest he go to his grave with his sins still upon him," he insisted. "Is he so very sick?" In the ivy of the ruined outbuildings, tumbled now almost to the ground, an owl called, eerily hooting. All about them, the dried brown leaves of the scrub oak rustled and whispered, driven by the warm night wind. The woman stopped in the doorway. She repeated, "Nobody else? Who else could I get now? They must bury him tomorrow." She considered a long time. She said at last, "Where are you from?"
"Only from Corticardno. Not too far."
"How do you know what's too far?" she said. She looked past him at the rough little stout mountain pony. "F? I say, if he comes, he must ride the horse. He gave a rough laugh. What? I walk while a sin-eater rides my horse? But if the man were too weak to walk... Very well. Let him ride. Both ways, she said. You will bring him back again.
Yes, yes, he said. Both ways.
Once the man had done his work, they could see about that. There was a heap of stones close by, and he went and sat down upon it gingerly, hugging his jacket about him. No need, however great, should drive him closer to that chill grey place, where the light glimmered, faint as a moonstone, cobweb-covered, through the hole of the window.
Go and tell him, and let him make haste. I can't wait all night.
I'll tell him. But she turned back once again. Both ways.
Both ways, both ways, he promised impatiently.
He added, for suppose the man were truly too sick to come, suppose he were to die upon the road.
What ails him?
He is hungry, said the woman, and went into the cottage. The glimmer came from rushlights made from the reeds that grew by the river's edge, the green skin peeled back, the pith dipped in melted mutton fat, forming a sort of wick. Through its feeble flickering you could discern a second doorway, leading to an inner room. From this room there came now a boy or a man, from the gaunt, gangling height, the foolish, gentle face, you might never be quite sure. Even the hair, a wild thatch almost to shoulder length, was of ashen pallor, so bleached as to seem the white hair of old age. She glanced towards the inner room, questioning. He shrugged hopelessly. A thin arm was crooked across the flat belly. His face was streaked with tears.
Mother, it's terrible to have not enough to eat. My father lies there sick, moaning, and all I can think about is that I am hungry.
She took his hand in hers. The poor, thin hand, fingers, noded and brittle-looking as the twigs from the long-abandoned jackdaw's nests.
You shall eat, she said. Eat, mother.
There had been no meal in that house for many days. She gestured with her head to the dim figure sitting outside on the heap of stones.
He has come for the sin eater. But my father?
She looked into his face, a strange look, intent, compassionate, yet fiercely resolute.
Yanto, she said, you must go with the man. I?
He was terrified, panic-stricken, freeing himself from her grasp to beat the air in front of him with meaningless gestures, like a child deprived of its toy.
I couldn't, to eat a dead man's sins.
She fought, head back, to get possession of his flailing hands.
Hush, now hush, listen, you are hungry. To eat from a dead man's breast, the food would choke me.
Yanto, they pay you also. They will give you money. But he only struggled and whimpered, rearing away from her, oblivious to reason.
I'd rather starve.
We were all starving. The husband had been ill for many weeks. She dared not leave him long enough to go forth and try to earn or beg or steal in the faraway villages. The nearest town was 20 miles or more. The boy was too witless to send, and with increasing weakness she had lost gradually even the will to try.
If not for yourself, Yanto, For all of us. For him.
The poor vague eyes, unfocused, came at last to rest, looking wretchedly back into hers.
If he has no food, will he die?
She turned away her head from the innocent gaze. She knew that his father must die, whether he ate or no. But she said, yes.
Then, F, just for this once, and they will pay me.
But he broke down again, sobbing and trembling.
To eat from the breast of a corpse, to take the sins.
But, Ianto, this is what I am trying to say to you. She caught his hand again, urgently whispering. To take the sins, you must eat from the body. But if you don't eat the food there, if you bring it away, not eat. Eat nothing there, Ianto. Not one scrap, not one crumb. Say the prayers. Tell the people to let you alone with the body while you eat. But don't eat. Bring the food away with you.
And so, in that way, I should not eat the sins.
But still the poor, feeble intellect staggered at the thought of the ordeal to be endured.
To see a dead man. To say the prayers, to wail and scream, to be left alone with him, he implored. Mother, must I go?
She bent all her strength to uphold her will against his.
Yes, you must go. And bring back the food. Bring it here.
It was dreadful to see the gentle face lose its innocence, the dawn of idiot cunning in his eyes.
But not for myself, Mother. Isn't that it?
The money.
I don't want the money, he said.
But the food. His thin arm hugged the aching emptiness of his belly.
I don't want the food, she said.
It's not for me. I shall not touch one crumb of it. Not one crumb. But she could not prevent the turn of her anguished heart towards that inner room where her man lay moaning. The turn of her anxious eyes. The boy said,
Ah, no. Not for you. For him. You shall eat it all, she said,
and bent her head guiltily, not meeting the return of his innocent, foolish faith and joy. He went with the farm servant, trembling. His mother had thrown a woolen shawl about his head and shoulders. The man saw only the old young face, hooded, and the wild white hair. But the widow, meeting them at the farmhouse door, held her lantern high and cried out,
What is this you have brought me? This is no sin-eater. This is a boy.
He can eat as well as another, I suppose, said the man.
But he was abashed at having been tricked, sought further to rehabilitate himself.
Better, perhaps. A boy is young and strong. To bear the burden of the sins. Do you call this strong? She said,
pushing the boy before her into the lighted kitchen, turning the poor, thin, zany face to hers. You could see her heart sink within her.
And as for young, is this poor child to take on the evil of a grown man's whole days?
He is the sin-eater, said the man, shrugging.
Let him eat.
He threw himself down on the high-backed oak settle at the open hearth, where, despite the oppressive heat of the night, the fire spluttered and sparked.
At any rate, there's no other.
I have searched 3 days, and as it is, have had to walk all this way while he rode my horse, and hold him on after time from tumbling off.
He is weak, said the woman, and looked at him pityingly.
I am hungry, said the boy.
The corpse was laid out in the little parlour where candlelight glowed from the tall dresser, with its rows of gold lustre jugs. A white sheet was pulled up to the chin, a china dish balanced upon the dead breast, and heaped on the dish was food. Thick slices of bacon, pink and glistening white, cut from the home-cured joints that hung from the beams in the kitchen ceiling, brown faggots, homemade also, aromatic with herbs, eggs boiled and shelled, raw onions sliced across, fresh-baked bread, spread thinly with the butter that the farmhouse wives so salted that the hired servants would not take too much of it, great wedges of cake, dark and sticky, slabs of crumbling white cheese. The boy stood looking at it and slavered at the jaws. The family, hastily summoned, crowded in after him and stood with bent heads round the bier. The old, accustomed, calm, the young shying like frightened ponies in the candlelight that flickered in the shadows, so that beneath its shroud the body seemed to move. They waited for the boy to speak. The boy could not speak. His heart was like water within him. His mouth drooled saliva at the sight of the food. An old man said at last,
Shall we not begin?
The widow had protected his youth from their scrutiny, keeping him in shadow, muffling his old young face again into its woolen shawl. Too late now to find another. She had done her best. She wanted no argument. She prompted him, murmuring, fearful, the opening words of the sin-eater's terrible prayer. He had heard his father rehearsing it often enough, the sibilant muttering, the pauses while the food was gobbled down, bit by ceremonious bit, the crescendo of importunity, storming heaven, the shriek of horror, real or pretended, as the prayer at last was answered, the sins transmitted to the living from the dead, the precipitate flight, eerily wailing, staying only to pick up the money, by custom flung after the outcast into the farmyard mire. But the words! The howl of a fox he could imitate so that the vixen cried back to him, the hoot of an owl, the scream of the kite. But these sounds had no words. He knew no words. He began to mumble, desperate, imitating, ape-like, a meaningless babble of sound. They shifted their feet uneasily, only half listening, only half watching him, afraid of the moment to come, part of that moment, yet wishing to be no part of it, giving him deliberately only a divided attention, yet conscious, and with a growing consciousness, that all was not as it should be. The widow made small, urgent, hidden gestures towards the body. The time had come to eat. The butter was yellow in the candlelight, gleaming gold sovereigns of it ringing the brown batch loaves. His bowels melted within him. Inside his mouth his cheeks seemed to sweat saliva. He stretched out a shaking hand towards the food, but his mother's voice hissed in his ear. Not one scrap, not one crumb. His hand dropped back. She had counseled him hastily, feverishly coaching him in the part he must play, knowing him not capable of improvisation. Now, obedient, he stumbled through the simple sentences.
You must all go. I am one that eats alone.
The old men were astonished, protesting.
The sin-eater eats before witnesses,
the boy repeated.
I am one that eats alone.
Witnesses must be present to see it when the sin passes.
You shall hear it, promised the boy. When the sin passes.
The shriek of mortal terror, the terrible wailing.
If we stand in the next room, urged the widow, abetting him, we shall hear when the sin passes.
The sin eater was not as other sin eaters. In her heart, she doubted his efficacy. But he was the best she could do. Her husband must be buried tomorrow. She prayed again for no argument, and meanwhile, uneasy but indomitable, drove them all out, reluctantly shuffling into the kitchen next door. Ears pressed against oak, they heard the mutterings again, wordless, unmeaning, then silence. The boy, obedient, was stuffing his threadbare pockets with the food, was lining the torn shirt with it, close up against his naked body, fat against thin, white, glossy fat pressed close against the hard rib caging that painfully ridged the blue-white skin. The faggots, crushed by the all-concealing shawl, exploded, dry and mealy, aromatically fragrant. The hard white whites of the eggs were slippery and cold, pressed between narrow oval slices of batch bread. The butter oozed and melted, yellow as gold. He set up a shrill chanting, importuning heaven in a stream of wordless sound, for the shifting to himself of the dead man's sins. When we hear the scream, said the old man, avidly listening, it will be the sin passing. The chanting ceased. Within the little parlour, the boy was nerving himself for the screaming. There was nothing to scream for. He had not eaten the food. The sins would not pass to him. And yet he must somehow open his mouth and, weak and sick as he was, find the strength to begin. In its corner, the grandfather clock ticked away the minutes, urgently. Pale against dark gold of old lustre, the candlelight flickered from the tall oak dresser. Uneasily the dead man lay, shifting beneath his shroud with the shifting of the shadows. On the still breast, the dish lay empty. His mouth opened. He dragged up a deep breath from his labouring lungs, lurched sick and trembling against the bier, knowing that he had no strength, no power, no will to meet the task before him. Crouched there, shuddering, and did not know how to start screaming. But the lurch against the bier had shifted the weight of the dish, tipped it crazily, unbalanced now as it was by the loss of the food. He saw the beginning of the slow slide, impeded by the folds of the shroud, but inevitable nevertheless, and flung out a hand to save it. His fingers grasped it. He hung over the corpse, clinging to the edge of the dish, but heavy and greasy with bacon fat. It slid inexorably out of his hands, and a moment later had crashed into a thousand fragments onto the scrubbed white stone of the floor. He let out one startled yell. The door burst open. They all stood gaping, and, hysterically screaming, he thrust his way through them and was out. Out into the night air, under the stars, and fleeing down the mountainside to the place he called his home. If they flung gold after him, if the servant recollected his promise of safe conduct, he waited for neither. After the long strain of the night, panic had him fast and faint with lack of food. Yet he rushed on and on, stumbling through the hanging forests, across the rough grassland, plunging through the river, waist high. The scrub oak again, so at last collapsed, sobbing outside the ruined cottage, at his mother's feet. She could not wait even to comfort or assist him. She burst out. Have you brought the food? He dragged himself to his feet, painfully, began to unwrap the shawl, to extract from beneath it the poor, battered remnants of that once splendid feast. The crumbled faggots, the split and bulging eggs, the fine white bacon gone limp and greasy now from long contact with the sweating body. She took it from him silently, piece by piece, scraped with a cupped palm the melting butter from the hollow of his waist, scraped it off again onto a crust of bread. She said at last, "Is this all of it?" "All of it. Not one morsel eaten. Not one crumb." His heart rose light as a bird at the thought of it. The mission accomplished. Temptation resisted. The reward, untarnished, now to come. But the cunning crept back, frightened, defensive, as she took the food and turned away into the house.
"Where are you taking it? It's mine. You promised."
Famished, exhausted, he began to drag himself after her.
"You're not going to eat it yourself. You're not giving it all to him."
"You shall have it," she promised. "All of it." The sins of the simple farmer, what are they? An ounce of mutton underweight, a drop or two of water in the milk, a woman coveted, a word in anger, a curse, a blow. But the sins of the sin-eater, the long accumulation of sin upon sin, of sins unrepented, unshriven, unforgiven, of sins stolen from dead men's souls for gain. Who shall take on the sins of the sin-eater? She had known all along that he was at the point of death, and now the mother came out and took her son's hand and led him, innocent, through to the inner room where the father lay, with the food spread out upon his naked breast. Today's story was The Sins of the Fathers by Christiana Brand. It was read by Jasper Lestrange. As always, thank you for listening, and until next time, sweet dreams.